Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Kaylin doesn't like the music. Hello, everybody. This is a recorded version because our live stream is down because of crazy technology and Hurricane Sandy. But we are excited to be here. We're going to have a great show. We have Sam Richmond in, and we also have Kaitlyn Robin in. And this has been a really crazy week. There's a big hurricane, and it's very, very interesting how different the situation was for so many people. I mean, some people got crushed, like in Far Rockaway. Other people totally, you wouldn't even know. Their neighborhood was fine. There might be a downed tree or whatever, and, they're completely fine. Of course, there were also a lot of small businesses that really suffered, and that was kind of the most poignant to me, all these, like, kind of slow food businesses, sustainable businesses, entrepreneurial, small business, guys trying to work hard and grow their business. And then all of a sudden a lot gets destroyed. But you guys did an unbelievable job covering the effects of Hurricane Sandy from the food perspective. So great job, Joe. Are you there, Joe? Yeah, I mean, you guys had, 38 to 40 interviews with different food people recorded over 2 days right post-hurricane? Yeah, for sure. So I know, we're being sponsored today by Fairway Market. I mean, their Red Hook store got destroyed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Anne's office was 6 feet above the ground, and she still had the first 4 feet of her space all covered, t-shirts, all her press that's ever come out, a lot of cheese that was on the lower shelves. And in fact, the water even picked up her 20-foot refrigerator, and then it couldn't open, so very, very wild stuff. Yeah, Red Hook really suffered, and I was running up there this morning, and yeah, there's just people's entire homes just like out on Van Brunt Street because I guess everything just got super soaked. Then I know you interviewed Ann Saxelby, and then you talked about food hunger and hunger relief as well, right?
Right, we talked to Margaret.
Okay.
This population, in addition to the population she already has to serve. Mm-hmm. So, a lot of people out of their homes, and it's just, it's very good.
Yeah, and you guys did a very good job. I read the New York Times, right, a couple of days after the hurricane, like on Wednesday, for instance, and the sports section had hurricane stories. The, of course, business section, the A page, was all about it. Then you get to the food section, and it's like, leeks are in season. They didn't have a single piece of coverage, whether it be for the farms or the restaurants. I would bet $100 that there won't be a single thing in this issue, or maybe there might be a little piece, but that should be a cover story. They have to take food as seriously as we do. And anyway, I definitely think you raised the bar. And Aaron Fairbanks did a really, really great job. 40 interviews, all food related. Very, very interesting. So we are now in studio with Kaitlyn Robin, who is just an unbelievable friend and interesting person. She is a lawyer. She also owns a restaurant. Then we are with Sam Richmond, and he is a very, very interesting chef. We've worked together for a few years through Heritage Foods, and he has a very interesting private supper club, and we're going to be talking about Mexican food because he has a lot to say about that. So welcome, guys.
Thank you.
Hello.
So it's interesting. We were talking about this, the challenges of a small business owner, you know, and hurricanes included. I mean, was it? It is challenging, right, to run a small business, and hurricanes must add even more pressure.
Well, running a small business is awful all the time, but in the hurricane, when you own it, when the East Village, which is where both of my places are, Grape and Grain Against Grain on 6th Street between B and C, and if you've seen any of the news coverage of what happened on Avenue C with, like, cars floating, I mean, our basement got hammered, our walk-in cooler, the compressor is down, you know, but fortunately everyone is safe, and the resolve of the East Village community is remarkable.
Yeah, is this real time? I mean, you also have always worked for, or very often worked for, you know, kind of independents. I mean, you're not like a corporate chef or anything like that. I mean, it must be challenging to, there's no rules. There's no, you just pick up your pieces, get people on the phone, get them into work, right? I mean, it's hard.
Right. Yeah. The day after the hurricane at Grand Electric, I was still there. A few employees had to walk and hitchhike about 3.5 hours to get to work. But, you know, everybody pulls in and helps out when they can, and things still run.
So would you say, I mean, Caitlin, you're a lawyer, would you say that a hurricane like this is a time of honesty and people rising to an occasion, or would you say it's a time for dishonesty? I mean, you see anti-looting messages on the cover of papers, people worried about it, and then I wonder, people suing or taking advantage of a bad situation?
Well, it seems crazy to me. I mean, fortunately, in the East Village and Lower East Side, we haven't seen any looting, and most contact I have is people, you know, getting out there to try and support local businesses, going out for drinks in businesses that are just serving via candlelight, going to volunteer. I like to think that the looting is limited. And as far as lawsuits, I mean, I think the problem for a lot of businesses trying to recover for this is that most places that were affected by flooding really don't have insurance coverage. I mean, the amount of people that actually can get flooding coverage are able to, you know, weren't affected by the storm. I think it's something like 15% mm-hmm. of small businesses actually have flooding coverage. And if you're in Red Hook or you're on Avenue B, obviously you can't buy it because of where the water table is. So, you know, I think a lot of people who got wrecked are going to need to count on the community. And I like to think that, you know, that stuff is very limited.
Now, is the insurance world, I mean, is it a fair one? I mean, obviously, they can't just insure anybody for anything all the time. But, I mean, is the way FEMA, and you must be hearing people ask you to help me get my FEMA loan, or, I mean, how does that all work? Is it a good system?
Honestly, I have very limited experience with FEMA, and this will be my first time, but I know as a member of the trial bar, like, we're being asked to take classes, to reach out and do help for both small businesses and individuals who have been affected by the storm. So we'll see to what level, you know, people are able to reach out and receive assistance. I know that there will be money granted to individuals, but as far as businesses, the most that you're looking at is getting a loan. You probably won't be eligible for a grant of any type.
Yeah, right. It's like those 30-year loans, right, that you have to pay off in time.
I'm not even sure what they're offering. And also the information from, like, the mayor's office has been fairly vague at this stage, too.
So as an important person at a very important law firm, it is kind of your job, though, to go and figure all this stuff out, right? Because
Thank you for that qualification.
No, it's a challenge. You have to navigate a lot of bureaucratic rules.
My firm has a lot of clients who were heavily affected in the Rockaways, including nursing homes and hospitals. So I imagine, you know, in the weeks to come, there's going to be a lot of work and a lot of effort in the New York City legal community as far as outreach efforts for both individuals, businesses, and clients as they need advice, insurance, and how to regroup with their lives.
You've been the top dog at a couple places, and now you have your own kind of supper club, and which we want to talk about in a bit. But what is the greatest challenge of running an independent business and being in charge of a bunch of people at a restaurant, for instance?
I can't say there's a greatest challenge. It's a different curveball every single day. You know, I think trying to It depends on the business. For me, you know, staffing's always a huge nightmare. But then it can be a great benefit when you find a great team and have them working together. It's the most one of the most enjoyable things as well.
Staffing is very hard because you need people to be great at what they do, not just okay, right? Because people have to have a perfect experience every time they come in.
When you're aiming for excellence, yes.
Now you, I mean, staffing must be, you cycled through people, no? I mean, you must line of work.
Any restaurant, I think, has like the lifespan of servers is maybe a year tops. But I have to say we have a great crew and they have been unbelievable this week as far as, you know, a bunch of our wait staff lives in Brooklyn in neighborhoods that were not as heavily affected and worked hard to bring in ice, to bring in candles, to bring in plasticware, whatever we needed to get up and operational and sort of triage what has been a terrible, terrible situation. So,
and so you did open, right? You did.
We've been open every night, and it's unbelievable. A bunch of East Village people who maybe didn't have places to stay have been coming out and supporting. And I think, you know, before looking at the insurance aspects that businesses are looking to, I mean, the likelihood of coverage, it's a long and hard process. The immediate thing that people can do right now is go out and support businesses from below 39th Street in Manhattan and to neighborhoods in Brooklyn and neighborhoods in Staten Island. Just go spend their money there.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. Staten Island really had a tough time. I mean, are there a lot of restaurants in Staten Island and stuff? I really don't know how the food, like, we didn't have any interviews. Joe, did we have a single interview with Staten Island? Yeah, it's an interesting thing. And then, we did talk about the Rockaways a lot because Chris Barachini, the owner of Roberta's, lives out there. And he said it was just devastating. Like, entire mile-long strips of the boardwalk were gone. So, very, very interesting. I mean, yeah, it was a challenge to get everyone into work. And, of course, you know, for Heritage Foods, you always have to keep on going because the pigs are constantly being delivered. And, you know, people on the West Coast are expecting their food. So it is a challenge to keep things going and find out who is open, who could you deliver to, but Palafrede did a good job for us. So we're going to transition talking about the hurricane to talking about some other less severe storm-related conversation. So we'll take a break and we'll come right back and talk about, among other things, Mexican food.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. We support Heritage Radio Network because all you folks listening are so genuine, so dedicated to serious food, so much a part of what this country needs to strive to become. People like you are few and far between, and it's obvious to us at Fairway that we've got to stick together. Our desire is that the word gets out about Heritage Radio Network in its support for serious food, foodstuffs that offer memorability and timelessness, authenticity and rarefied quality. This country grew too fast to have established any degree of a heritage. Europe had centuries to develop one. America has not. Heritage Radio Network serves to hasten the evolution of a society that often appears coarse and uninterested. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
HRN, turning America less coarse. I like that. So, we got Sam, who's kind of an expert on Mexican food, which is, you know, I'm born and raised in New York City, and we didn't really have much Mexican influence. I mean, how did you and that culture kind of connect?
Yeah, it was an accident. I took a trip to Mexico.
Whereabouts?
I traveled all over the southern half of the country, a big loop from Mexico City and Oaxaca, Puebla, Chiapas, the Yucatan. And I didn't really go with any intention other than taking a little break from New York and doing some traveling. And I always liked what I thought I knew of the food of Mexico, but eating it there was a totally eye-opening experience, that it's an incredibly rich cuisine. And then just started dabbling with with it and reading about it a lot afterwards. And, you know, knew Brad at Colony, and his partners were opening a Mexican restaurant, so asked me to run the place.
And you had had experience? I mean, you had taken what you had seen and experimented with what fascinated you, you know, beans, ingredient combinations, you know, what was it?
Well, I grew up in Durham, New Hampshire, and it was fun eating at, I think, a place called Margaritas, and the next town over that had some fajitas. It's great flavors, whatever Tex-Mex was, and whatever trickled down to popular American food. But then seeing that, wow, this is actually a really, really rich and interesting cuisine, as rich as any Mediterranean cuisine, as rich as any Italian cuisine. Also really interesting being an American and cooking now, I think there's a quest amongst young chefs and older chefs to say, okay, what does it mean to cook in America? What is American cuisine? And looking at Mexican food, where you still have techniques and tools that are thousands of years old that predate the Spanish, I think helps unlock that, because there's more documented history about mm-hmm. what was eaten, by earlier non-European cultures than there really is in North America.
Mm, for sure. Now, what is Mexican food? I mean, is there a single, are there ingredients or ways that they prepare the food? But I mean, how would you distinguish that between, for instance, Brazilian food or, you know, food from North America or Italy?
Well, Mexican food is incredibly regional. So state by state, it's really different. And then even within states, Oaxaca, for instance, has a really diverse terrain. So even city by city, incredibly different ingredients used. But there's a few things that I think tie everything together. One is corn, and then the treatment of corn with an alkaline solution to nixtamalize the corn, or hominy is basically corn that's been cooked with calcium hydroxide to dissolve the hull.
Hmm.
And after you grind this treated and soaked corn, you get masa, which is the dough used to make tortillas, as well as tamales and a load of other antojitos and stews. And that is the nutritional basis of Mesoamerica. So not just Mexico, but Guatemala and mm-hmm. further down into Central America as well. And that's what actually the Europeans got wrong when they brought corn back. They forgot the nixtamalization step and tried to subsist off of a corn diet and got a niacin deficiency, pellagra. How do you pronounce it? Pellagra.
Pellagra?
Yeah.
And from not having the ability to break the corn husk down?
Well, they didn't know that was an important step. And basically, when you just eat corn, your body's not able to take in all the nutrients. You just don't digest everything.
It shoots straight out.
You've seen that every time you've eaten corn on the cob.
Yeah.
And whereas if you nixtamalize the corn, if you cook it in calcium hydroxide or some other basic solution first, removing the hull, you're able to take in a lot more nutrients. And then all of a sudden, corns plus bean and rice is a complete protein, and you can subsist off that. So corn, beans, chilies, tomatoes, that's really, I would say, what you would find across Mexico, making up, you know, the most important building blocks of the cuisine.
And how has that been held in America? I mean, in North America, I mean, I'm trying to think who are the big people. I mean, we were talking earlier. I mean, Rick Bayless, he's a very big proponent of good Mexican cuisine.
Rick Bayless is an amazing ambassador from Mexico to the Americas, to the English-speaking world. He spent a lot of time there. He's really articulate, and he's got great shows and cookbooks. And one thing that Chicago has that's a great advantage over New York is an infrastructure for making the building blocks of Mexican food, making real tortillas from fresh masa instead of from maseca, which is like a dried corn product generally made from GMO corn and loaded
seca
up with,
being dry.
Yeah, exactly. And the name of the brand is maseca. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the quote-unquote fresh tortillerias around New York are using this really horrible corn flour.
However, can we know who is and who isn't?
Well, there's two places that do the real deal, and they're fantastic. Tortilleria Nixtamal out in Corona, Queens, which is where we got all of our fresh masa from every day at Gran Electrica. And in addition to that, there's Hot Bread Kitchen in
up Harlem? In Harlem, exactly, who they don't specialize. They specialize in all kinds of breads from around the world, but they've got a really great masa and tortilla program, and they sell at the farmers markets and I think Whole Foods as well.
And from someone who doesn't know where it came from, how could they distinguish, like, in their palate, which
one is which? That's a really interesting question. I think that in general, most people who are aficionados of Mexican food haven't really worked up necessarily the flavor memory. You know, you can eat an amazing pizza from Roberto's or Franny's and know instantly and describe why it's better than a slice of Ray's down the street. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that if I gave you a fresh tortilla off the press made from masa ground by Tortilleria Nixtamal, and we put that next to a tortilla made from Maseca that had been sitting in a plastic wrap bag in the grocery store for a long time, you would be able to tell on a blind taste test immediately which you preferred. Mm-hmm. However, without that side-by-side comparison, I'm not sure that people have eaten enough tortillas to be able to build up the memory and the vocabulary to describe why one is better than the other. It's only going to come the more and more good tortillas we eat so that we have some basis for comparison.
So it's like child pornography. You can't explain it, but you know it when you see it.
Sure.
Or know it when you taste it. No, that is very, very interesting. I mean, there is this reputation of Mexican being a cheap food and being really bad in New York, but like good in, you know, Texas and New Mexico through via the Tex-Mex. And then, of course, LA is famous for it. But, you know, why is Mexican bad, you know, considered bad? I mean, what is this reputation?
I just think that's off. I feel like New York finally has some great places.
I know, it's said of New York. I mean, I'm not the first one to say it.
I know, but there are heavy hitters in the game now. Yeah. And I'm sure you would agree.
I totally agree. And I think it's actually been off for a while. When people make that comparison, they're talking about, you know, San Francisco's got great little taquerias. Chicago's got great little taquerias. Obviously, Texas and New Mexico and places closer to the Mexican border with large populations have these. But actually, so do we in New York. And Sunset Park and Roosevelt Avenue are really thriving Mexican communities that have excellent food. And the flavors are all spot on. They're really, really delicious. I love going to eat there because it all tastes correct. I don't love going to eat there for the same reason. I mean, I love going to eat at a lot of places in Chinatown and the flavors are correct. But I wish I can see the boxes of, you know, chickens that are being delivered, and I know I don't want to be eating those.
Right.
And
so it's an ingredient thing.
It's an ingredient thing, and it's a bummer because I wish I could have those flavors and not feel guilty about eating them. Mm-hmm. And so that's precisely what, you know, I was trying to pull off at Grand Electrica, not messing around with it, not trying to gussy things up at all, present the very simplest food, the same stuff that you would eat in a bodega in Roosevelt Avenue, but with, you know, heritage pork.
Do you think it's a culture of the fact that New Yorkers eat out within like a 10 block radius of their apartment? Maybe it's not the best stuff there, but you're willing to make an effort. Because I know just in my daily routine of working a lot, as many New Yorkers do, you just have a rotation of places you go to, but some of the best places in New York are really off the beaten path.
So, like, it's Chinese food, maybe. Is that similar? You're like, oh, I don't like Chinese food in my neighborhood that much, but there might be 100 great Chinese restaurants. Just you have to go somewhere to find them.
Fair enough.
And the kind of ingredient thing is very interesting because, yeah, did people be like, hey, what the hell? How come this is so expensive? I just spent $100 a person to eat at a Mexican restaurant. I mean, that kind of ignores totally the provenance of where everything comes from.
Yeah, I'm not certain what percentage of the people. I think there's probably a large number of people who ate there and understood, you know, what went on, that this is something that's a little bit different from a bodega. But if you go through some of the Yelp comments, you'll see that there's also a few number of people who don't understand it and who say, why am I paying more than $1.50 for a taco? A taco is a food that should cost $1.50, mm-hmm. which is just absolutely incorrect. Not all tacos are created equal. Show me, Mr. Yelper, how you can make a $1.50 taco using really nice ingredients profitable. Show me how you can even do it for $1.50 at cost.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
There's nothing more soul-crushing than Yelpers.
Oh, my God.
Spend way too much of my energy and life, blood.
Do you care?
Thinking about it all the time. I have daily telephone calls about Yelpers.
Because you're crazy? Or because you think everyone who owns a restaurant is looking at
them? A, I'm a psycho. B, half the comments, particularly about service, are always right. C, most of the comments about food are totally wrong and written by annoying people. Who vent. It's self-masturbatory.
What's your menu? I mean, your menu is a little bit of all things. It's kind of like a bar menu, right?
It's true. Yeah, definitely.
I mean, which is delicious. It's probably everyone's favorite way to eat, you know, small plates of a lot of different things.
Well, I'm actually curious, like, what Mexican places he likes to eat at.
Which is the one that you mentioned, the 2-star one?
Oh, I mean, also because I'm a creature of my neighborhood and my bar's on 6 and B, I go to Empalon Cucina, Alex Dupac. It's awesome. And I also like Hecho and Dumbo, which is near me. And I go across the bridge for La Superior because it's also close, and I think it's awesome too. I don't know if you eat those places, but
I went to Hecho and Dumbo, which I thought was really good. But generally, especially since I started this the Grand Electrica project, I've been very overwhelmed with Mexican food and haven't gone to eat that much of it outside of the restaurant. But I mean, there's a tiny little place close to me on Graham Avenue, just south of Scholes in Williamsburg, that I'm not even sure what the name of it is. It has one name on the door and one on the awning and a different one on the menu. Mm-hmm. I think it's called New Mexico Place, but their gorditas and their picaditas, like a huarache, were like my gold standard for what I was trying to accomplish. And really, really delicious enchiladas. I mean, there's a place out in Sunset Park that a lot of people like called Matamoros. There's a place in the back of a bodega, again, on I think 24th or 25th and 4th Avenue, just getting into Sunset Park, called Carmelita's Deli. Mm. Interesting stuff like that. And then, yeah, Nixtamal is a really, really great spot for simple taqueria with awesome tortillas.
What about like now a very big restaurant like Dos Caminos or Rosa Mexicana? That lady started early, before a lot of people did. I mean, is there good stuff there? I mean, there must be. Like, the guacamole is fresh, no? Or
I can't comment. I've never eaten at any of them. So,
but do you suspect that they're inauthentic and cater towards an American palate and don't stay true to anything?
At least those places got people excited about the idea of adding cilantro or basic actual Mexican spices to food rather than like mix from a box added to ground beef.
No, absolutely. And I think also for Rosa Mexicana has been around for a while. So to have a successful restaurant that is also a little bit fancy and is Mexican food, which is often looked at as a cheap cuisine, is a huge and great accomplishment.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure definitely helps pave the way for other places trying to do justice to Mexican food.
Well, let's talk about that, paving the way. I mean, that's a real interesting thing. I mean, there's probably no city in the world that has a more diverse array of cuisines than New York City, you know, in the five boroughs. But, you know, still there is a hierarchy. Like, I remember when David Chang got a couple stars for Momofuku, like everyone, or Momofuku-sama, I forget which one it was. That was kind of a groundbreaking moment because there was a certain type of cuisine that was not in the pantheon of 2 stars. They got it. So let's, I don't know, unpack this idea of New York City kind of being as a receptacle of ethnic cuisines and how we judge it hierarchy wise. I mean, Mexican has been slow to come.
Yeah, I mean, I think an interesting litmus is to look at who the New York Times, what kinds of cuisines they award 4 stars to, like mm-hmm. their highest level, which is the rating system that is probably held in most, the highest regard in New York. And so you have, for a long time, it's just been French. You know, in the 70s and 80s of New York, it was well understood that French food is the highest cuisine you can possibly have.
And those guys, Alain Sayac, Jacques Pepin, you know, Julia Child was in the French style. So, you know, these were all the big dogs of the chef world back in the 70s.
All serious cooking is done by the French. Mm-hmm. That was the myth. Though, not without reason, the French have done a great job codifying their cuisine. And so now you look today, you have Danielle and Jean Georges, and you have Per Se, which is an American restaurant, but definitely, you know, heavily influenced by French. But then finally, you know, in the last decade or so, people came to realize that, wow, Japanese food is a cuisine worth paying attention to. Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden, fancy restaurants are allowed to be Japanese as well. And then, you know, when what's the name? I'm totally blanking on the name now. The Italian place.
Del Posto Mark
got
Ladner.
Four stars. Exactly. So Italian food can enter that realm of
and
excellence.
And that was an achievement because no one thought simple Italian pasta could have enough creativity behind it, because it was more about staying true to a tradition. So that kind of broke new ground.
Precisely.
Yeah. What about tableau too, right?
Tableau, yeah. I mean,
it
didn't get four stars. But
I'm not saying that, but just the idea that any sort of ethnic cuisine could like that sort of high volume and can be considered a fine dining setting.
Although, I mean, it's interesting it didn't succeed. But, you know.
But, I mean, I think the way has certainly been paved for a myriad of cuisines to be done at a really high level. You know, tableau is definitely an example. Pok-pok and what's Kin Shop, I think, or Thai restaurants that are done really, really well. But it'll be interesting to see, you know, what will be the next cuisine that is not French and is not Italian, is not Japanese, that will get a 4-star review in the Times. What's the next cuisine that people, you know, Franny's and Roberta's are sort of a little bit Italian inspired and just like really, really are having, you know, thriving businesses, and people love eating here and can play with really high end, you know, ingredients, and nobody blinks an eye. Mm-hmm. When will that happen to Mexican food? I think probably it will. There's enough, you know, new chefs and restaurateurs playing with it now that I think it's going to catch on.
No, that is interesting. I mean, when
I see in the reviews, though, that they always mention, like, when they talk about Alex Stupak cooking at Empalan Cochia, they always preface it with, oh, and you were a pastry chef at WD-50 and you worked, you know, at Alinea. Like, there always seems to be a preface, like, you cut your teeth on, like, high-end French or Italian or molecular gastronomy before you moved on to an ethnic cuisine.
Right, but it's still the thing that interests him. I mean, of everything that he could cook in the world, he said, I want to play with Mexican food.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, there's a service component to 4 stars as well. And, you know, you need to be able to bring hundreds of people. Well, you have to overcome this perception that it has to be cheap, because then you can't back it up with the front of the house service that you need for 4 stars. So it seems like it might take a generation or two for people to understand that, yes, it's okay to spend the same amount at a Mexican restaurant as Danielle.
Though you have actually a restaurant in Mexico City called Pujol that, according to the 50 best restaurant list, is, I think, number 13 or something like that. Anyway, really, really interesting food. There was a big Mesoamerica conference held in Mexico City this year with a ton of heavy-hitting chefs from not just limited to Mexican food, but I think just trying to bring cool food people down to Mexico to be aware that actually there's really interesting stuff going on. I think Ferran Adrià's brother is opening up something Mexican related in Barcelona, if he hasn't already. So I think, you know, there are already in the world, not necessarily in New York, successful, definitely 4-star caliber Mexican restaurants. So that probably will also help pave the way for New York.
Now, this is a weird question. It's a little bit of a transition, but for the past 2 weeks, this issue has come up. Do you think that, Mexico is not a, well, I don't know, maybe this is wrong, but I don't know how abundant it is. My friend Renato, who started the international office, said the more abundant a place is, the worse the cuisine. So like Costa Rica is in the middle of a most biodiverse rainforest on the planet, and their cuisine isn't that good. Whereas if it's very tough terrain, then somehow they make the most out of very little. Is that an observation you guys have made at all in your travels?
Maybe. I know people have commented a long time on Seattle of having like the best ingredients and the worst cuisine in
Seattle,
in America.
It's so true.
And I do, I guess it depends on your taste. For me, I think thriftiness is a really wonderful flavor.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons why I like Mexican food and I like Italian food so much is nothing's wasted, and you can see it in the cooking, and it produces great techniques. You know, if everything is, if every ingredient is scarce and is a luxury, you treat it with a great deal of respect. And I think, yeah, great cuisine is bred from that.
I'm going to say there are exceptions. I had a Polish roommate. I get depressed when I think about the food, what was brought. I know they have hard times, lots of potatoes, but there's nothing working.
Nothing working with them. Well, that is interesting. Yes, I mean, I guess when things are scarce, you end up making the most. Now, it's a woman-based cuisine, right? I mean, it's mainly mothers and grandmothers that are in the kitchens.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a little bit divided. You have men in the butcher shops and making chicharrón and making sausages, mm-hmm. but absolutely, the bulk of the cooking is done, traditionally has been and still is done by women. You know, really, really great places to eat are at fondas, at little market stalls, where it's maybe a woman and her daughter or one or two people just making, you know, lunch. The big meal of the day is called comida. So making this big late afternoon, like large meal, very simple stuff, but you never see a man doing that.
Hmm. Are there any male-based cuisines in the world? I mean, cultures where men are predominantly, I mean, in the chef world.
I mean, look at French restaurants. I mean,
the French,
but it's there. I think there's always a divide between what's done professionally
at home, yeah.
and what's done at home. And the same thing's true in Mexico. It, you know, there's definitely celebrated female chefs, but it's still probably a male dominated world in terms of modern Mexican restaurants.
Do you consider yourself a chef, Caitlin?
No,
not at all. You'd be the triple threat.
I'm a subpar line cook.
So you do know how to your way around the George Foreman grill pretty
That's
good.
That's right.
Though.
That's right.
So, Sam, now you're going to do a supper club. So is that going to be Mexican still? And are you going to do pop-ups at Grape and Grain and, you know, in their free space and all that?
We'll talk after.
Great. Yeah, I'm going to return to dinner at 525 that I was running before Grand Electrica, where that it's definitely not, you know, not Mexican food, though Mexican food showed up here and there. I always, you know, since this trip, have been fascinated by the cuisine and have loved studying it, and I'm going to continue to take inspiration from it and cook the stuff, whether it's you know a direct dish or playing around with a dish or flavors.
Yeah. Well, for sure. And how do people find out about it? Is there a blog they can go to?
Yep, they can go to 525dinner.blogspot.com or
525dinner.blogspot.com.
Yeah, that has everything. Or just email me, sammyrichman@yahoo.com.
Now we're going to prove that we have no listeners. No, just kidding. Tell me, Caitlin, you, website? Location? I mean, it's the perfect bar to go to for drinks and have dinner at.
It's grapeandgrain.net and atgbar.com. So we have two places, Grape and Grain, and then next door is Against the Grain, which is our craft beer bar. Has the same menu, but a ton of great beer.
Ton of great beer. Well, this has been a great, great show where we're really happy to have you guys make it out here. And again, congratulations to heritageradionetwork.org for, you know, putting so much attention to reporting on the food and farm effects of Hurricane Sandy. And remember, we are a 501c3 nonprofit organization. So we encourage you to log on to our website and make a donation. An end of your donation, any amount helps. And it allows us to continue doing interesting content and having food people of all shapes and sizes from all cultures and colors come onto the station and talk about what they do. So we are broadcasting live from Roberta's, 261 Moore Street, engineered and produced by Joe Galarraga and sponsored by Fairway Market, like no other market. So thanks for listening and stay tuned for Straight No Chaser and then the design show Burning Down the House.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio.
You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.